Acts 16, beginning at verse 25. And we're continuing in Philippi, where Paul and Silas have been imprisoned. But at midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. Suddenly, there was a great earthquake, so that the foundations of the prison were shaken. And immediately, all the doors were opened and everyone's chains were loosed. And the keeper of the prison, awaking from sleep and seeing the prison doors open, supposing the prisoners had fled, drew his sword and was about to kill himself. But Paul called with a loud voice, saying, "Do yourself no harm, for we are all here." Then he called for a light, ran in, and fell down trembling before Paul and Silas. And he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" So they said, "Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and you will be saved, you and your household." Then they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all who were in his house. And he took them the same hour of the night and washed their stripes. And immediately he and all his family were baptized. Now when he had brought them into his house, he set food before them, and he rejoiced, having believed in God with all his household. And when it was day, the magistrate sent the officers, saying, "Let those men go." So the keeper of the prison reported these words to Paul, saying, "The magistrates have sent to let you go. Now therefore depart and go in peace." But Paul said to them, "They have beaten us openly, uncondemned Romans, and have thrown us into prison. And now do they put us out secretly? No, indeed. Let them come themselves and get us out." And the officers told these words to the magistrates, and they were afraid when they heard that they were Romans. Then they came and pleaded with them and brought them out and asked them to depart from the city. So they went out of the prison and entered the house of Lydia. And when they had seen the brethren, they encouraged them and departed. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated. Before diving into our text for the night, let's review what we've seen thus far in chapter 16. Paul and Silas, now accompanied by Timothy and Luke, answer Paul's visionary call from a man in Macedonia to come across the Aegean Sea to visit with them. And they do that, and arriving across the sea, they travel inland to the city of Philippi, where they encounter a group of Jewish women praying at a riverside outside of the city walls. One of these women, Lydia, was a seller of purple. Every indication is that she was a very successful businesswoman. And as the missionary spoke to them about Jesus, we read, "The Lord opened her heart," that is Lydia's heart, "to heed the things spoken by Paul." She and her household were baptized, and she opened her home to provide a local base for the missionaries. After such an encouraging beginning, things took something of a downturn for the missionaries, though of course it was part of the Lord's perfect plan for them and for the people of Philippi. A slave girl possessed by a spirit of divination, a python spirit, we learned, followed the missionary band, constantly declaring, "These men are servants of the Most High God who proclaim the way of salvation." And this got old quickly, and Paul cast the evil spirit out of the girl. What was good news for her was not looked upon as such by her masters, who had been making much money from her fortune-telling. They seized Paul and Silas and dragged them before the authorities in the marketplace. A near riot ensued. And probably just to calm the crowd, the magistrates had Paul and Silas beaten with rods and cast into the inner prison, where they had their feet placed in stocks in the cell. And that is where we left them 2 weeks ago. Tonight we will see the Lord act into this desperate situation, glorifying himself through powerful acts that issued in salvation of another family in Philippi. We're going to consider this passage under two headings. First of all, the jailer saved in verses 25 through 34, and the missionaries vindicated in verses 35 through 40. Hence the name for our message, Salvation and Vindication. In all of this, we see an ongoing extension of God's grace among the Gentiles. So we begin with the jailer saved. I did read that he might have been a retired army officer, but probably not a sailor. We meet Paul and Silas in their cell, and the scene is not what we might expect. Verse 25, but at midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. Now it's midnight. I am usually asleep at midnight. Paul and Silas are still awake. This is likely due to the fact they had extreme pain in their backs from the beatings that they received, and they were in very uncomfortable stocks around their feet. But they're not complaining. They redeem their time by praying and singing hymns to God. Their faith was not shaken by the horrible treatment they had received. Not only do they pray, which we might do in such a circumstance, they also sing praise to God, which might not be something we would be so quick to do. Now, they certainly could justify complaining about their treatment. It had been unjust. That's probably what I would likely do. But they take a higher road, which honors God and bears witness to others. Because we read, and the prisoners were listening to them. Paul and Silas do not shrink from ministry, and here they have a captive audience. It's a joke. Their prayer and praise bears testimony to their faith and the God in whom their faith is placed. And God responds to their prayer and praise in a remarkable way. Verse 26, suddenly there was a great earthquake so that the foundations of the prison were shaken. And immediately all the doors were opened and everyone's chains were loosed. Now, earthquakes were common in this region, but this is no ordinary earthquake. I went to seminary in Southern California and experienced a number of earthquakes while I was there. Most of them were just minor. You just felt a little bit. But I was near the center of one of them up in the mountains with a friend one time, and it was rather major. It caused a landslide that blocked the road. We couldn't get down until they cleared the road. And in the house where I was, there were lots of objects on the shelves, and they just started shaking and shaking, and some coming down. And in the living room, there was this big bust of Beethoven, and it fell down and crashed on the hearth with just this huge sound. It was scary, but the results were both typical and seemingly random. That is what happens in an earthquake. That was not the case with this earthquake in Philippi. It was powerful. The foundation of the prison was shaken, but it was very specific in its damage. We read that immediately all the doors were opened and everyone's chains were loosed. Well, that was not the normal thing that would happen in an earthquake. It was God who was at work through this earthquake accomplishing his saving purposes. And it's not the first time we've encountered God sending earthquakes at pivotal moments. In Exodus 19, we read of God descending upon Mount Sinai as he makes covenant with Israel as his nation. And we read there that the whole mountain quaked greatly. Then you'll recall Matthew 27, when Jesus died upon the cross, the earth quaked and the rocks were split. And then more recently in our book of Acts, chapter 4, when the church was birthed at Pentecost, we read that when they had prayed, the place where they were assembled together was shaken. And at Philippi, God sends another earthquake, this time in response to prayer, and he does it to bring blessing. But not everyone saw it that way at first. Verse 27, and the keeper of the prison, awaking from sleep and seeing the prison doors open, supposing the prisoners had fled, drew his sword and was about to kill himself. Well, the first thing we see here is that the keeper of prison had fallen asleep on the job. Not really good for his resume. But the earthquake awakened him, and he was horrified when he looked and saw that the prison doors were open. This would not be a good circumstance for him. According to the Code of Justinian, Roman law, a guard who allows a prisoner to escape is liable to the punishment the prisoner would have received. Now, this would minimally be a beating, but sometimes it was viewed as a capital offense, as had been the case back in chapter 12 with the guards who were assigned to guard Peter when he escaped from prison. Those guards were put to death. And it is because of shame and fear of such an outcome that we read, supposing the prisoners had fled, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself. This was very much an honor-shame culture, and in a situation of such deep shame, suicide was viewed as an honorable alternative to punishment by the state. But thankfully, Paul intervened. verse 28. But Paul called with a loud voice, saying, "Do yourself no harm, for we are all here." Now, if you've ever watched prison films, you know there's usually no love lost between the prisoners and the guards. In calling for the guard not to harm himself, Paul does something exceptional. After all, the cell doors are open. The guard was the only obstacle between all the prisoners and freedom. What we would expect is for all the prisoners to burst forth past the guard out into the night. But apparently, Paul and Silas had enough influence over the others to keep the prisoners from escaping. So he could say to the jailer, "Do yourself no harm, we are all here." Then we read in verse 29, "Then the jailer called for a light, ran in, and fell down trembling before Paul and Silas." Staggered by this report from one of his prisoners, he got a lantern to see if what Paul said was true. And when the light cast upon the cells showed all prisoners present and accounted for, he fell down trembling before Paul and Silas. In a very real sense, he knew that his life was in their hands. Verse 30, and he brought them out and says, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" Now remember, for maximum security, Paul and Silas had been placed in the inner prison. And the jailer now leads them out from there and says, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" Now, the Greek word translated here as "sirs" is kurioi, and it's the plural form of the word kurios, which is often translated "lord" or "master." It is the same word that had been previously used in this chapter in reference to the masters of the slave girl with that evil spirit. And there's a sense in which the jailer now sees Paul and Silas as his masters, as his benefactors who can deliver him from shame. Now, it's hard to know exactly what he intends with his question, "What must I do to be saved?" After all, he could be thinking of his physical life, since the prisoners might still escape and bring down a death sentence upon him. He might be saying, "How can I be saved from the punishment that will come from this escape?" But it's also possible, and I think likely, that the jailer had heard about what Paul and Silas had been proclaiming throughout Philippi. Remember, that possessed slave girl had been shouting day after day, "These men are the servants of the Most High God who proclaim to us" what? "The way of salvation." The earthquake and its aftermath might lead the jailer to conclude that the Most High God was indeed at work on behalf of Paul and Silas. And that being so, he may very well be calling out to know the way of spiritual salvation, that way that they had been proclaiming. Regardless of which way he was intending the question, Paul and Silas answer him from the spiritual perspective, as we would expect. Verses 31 and 32. So they said, "Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and you will be saved, you and your household." Then they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all who were in his house. The answer to the jailer's inquiry about how to be saved is the gospel message. Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and you will be saved. And they add to this, "you and your household." And we see now that the jailer had taken Paul and Silas from the prison to his house, which was likely adjacent to the prison. And there they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all who were in his house. Verse 33, and he took them the same hour of the night and washed their stripes, and immediately he and all his family were baptized. Now, in this verse, we see two washings. First, the jailer washes the stripes, that is, the wounds of Paul and Silas, welcoming them into his house as honored guests, no longer really looking at them as prisoners under his control. But secondly, the jailer and his family are washed in baptism. As was earlier the case with Cornelius in chapter 10, and Lydia earlier in this chapter, the entire household was baptized. The principle of household baptism shows that under the new covenant, God continues to take the offspring of a believing parent into covenantal relation with himself. Verse 34, now when he had brought them into his house, he set food before them, and he rejoiced, having believed in God with all his household. So the jailer continues to treat them as honored guests. He sets out food before them. He has believed in God, and his family joins him in rejoicing. Now, I do want to note that the English translation is somewhat ambiguous here. The phrase, with all his household, properly modifies the verb translated, he rejoiced, not having believed in God. So with all his household, he rejoiced. Now, this doesn't mean that the other family members definitely didn't believe in God, but it does leave the matter open. As I've previously mentioned, I think this is another example of God's covenantal embrace as families, including children who have not yet professed faith. We see these household baptisms. This is the third one we've seen in the book of Acts. So in that first section tonight, we see the jailer saved. And secondly, we move now to the missionaries vindicated. Verse 35. And when it was day, the magistrate sent the officer saying, let those men go. Now from this verse, it appears that the jailer had taken Paul and Silas back from his house to the prison. And Paul and Silas surely went willingly because their whole purpose was that none of the prisoners would escape, that this jailer would not be in trouble. I wonder what the other prisoners thought, but we're not told anything about that. If the prisoners were all in their cells on this next day, then no harm would fall to the jailer at all. And it was on this day that the magistrates, these are the ones who had commanded them to be beaten and imprisoned, sent officers to the prison with the order, let those men go. Now, no reason for this command is given. It may be that the magistrates believed that, with order now restored, the men had already suffered enough punishment. Whatever the reasoning, the officers came to the jail with a message of freedom for Paul and Silas. Verse 36, so the keeper of the prison reported these words to Paul, saying, the magistrates have sent to let you go. Now, therefore, depart and go in peace. So he relays that message to Paul. His advice, depart and go in peace. That's what we would think would happen. He had no idea that Paul and Silas would do anything else, but he was soon to be surprised. Verse 37. But Paul said to them, they have beaten us openly, uncondemned Romans, and have thrown us into prison. And now do they put us out secretly? No, indeed, let them come themselves and get us out. Well, the big news here for the jailer is that Paul and Silas are Roman citizens. We find out later in Acts 22:28 that Paul was born a Roman citizen. You didn't have to be born in Rome for this. Philippi is one of the colonies of Rome, and there were a number of colony cities. We knew Paul lived in Tarsus, which is not one of those, but that's not necessarily where he was born. But in some way, he was born a Roman citizen, and as such, he had special privileges. We're told here that Silas also was a Roman with those privileges. And we get a sense of some of those privileges from a statement of Cicero, who wrote, to bind a Roman citizen is a crime, to flog him an abomination, to slay him almost an act of parricide, that is, killing a parent. So not only were Paul and Silas Roman citizens, they had been beaten, which Cicero said is an abomination, they had been beaten as uncondemned Romans. That is to say, they had been punished without any proper judicial proceeding to find them guilty of the crime. They'd been beaten as uncondemned Romans. They'd been thrown into prison as uncondemned Romans. And Paul will not allow their unjust treatment to escape the notice of the magistrates. He says, and now do they put us out secretly? No, indeed, let them come themselves and get us out. Verse 38. And the officers told these words to the magistrates, and they were afraid when they heard that they were Romans. And again, they had reason to be afraid. Commentator Ben Witherington explains, it was a serious matter, a very serious matter, when a local magistrate in a Roman colony took action against a Roman citizen, especially when he did so without proper cause or reason. The magistrates could lose their posts or be recalled and disgraced for such actions. Verse 39, then they came and pleaded with him and brought them out and asked them to depart from the city. Claiming his rights as a Roman citizen, Paul has demanded that the magistrates come themselves personally and openly to release the missionaries. And the magistrates, fearful of what could happen to them if word got out, accede to Paul's wishes. We read that they brought them out and asked them to depart from the city. And we might wonder why it was that Paul placed this demand upon the magistrates. Was he simply out for revenge in light of how he had been treated? The more likely reason is that Paul didn't want his experience to set a precedent for other Christians in Philippi or for future Christian missionaries to be treated unjustly. He acted not out of personal pride, but out of a concern for other Christians and the ongoing spread of the gospel. And then verse 40, so they went out of the prison and entered the house of Lydia, and when they had seen the brethren, they encouraged them and departed. Rather than rush out of the city, Paul and Silas returned to the house of Lydia that had been their ministry base in Philippi. And they wanted to give some parting words to the members of that newly born church. We read, when they had seen the brethren, they encouraged them and departed. And if you'll think back, one of the primary purposes of Paul's second missionary journey was to encourage young believers in the faith, many of whom he'd visited on his first journey. That was not the case with those in Philippi, but he continues his ministry of gospel encouragement. And only then does the missionary band depart from Philippi. Well, for concluding application, I'd like us to consider four areas here, four perspectives. The first is that Paul's ministry reached a diversity of people. Here in Philippi, there was a well-to-do businesswoman, Lydia. There was a slave girl who was demonically possessed. There was even a jailer who was an employee of the Roman government. Whether men or women, rich or poor, inside or outside government, the gospel is suited to the true spiritual needs of all kinds of sinners. Everyone has the same problem in sin. And the one gospel of God's grace through Jesus Christ is for everyone, not a select few based on some socioeconomic standing. Secondly, the lives of Lydia and the jailer show immediate fruit in hospitality and unity with others who share their Christian faith. Lydia opened her home, actually not just to feed Paul and Silas, but for them to stay there. The jailer brought them to his home, offered a meal, extended hospitality, which was very significant in this culture. And we should ask ourselves, do we value such unity within the Christian community? Do we practice hospitality as an expression of our faith? Thinking back to a song I used to sing in youth group, will they, the world, know that we are Christians by our love? Jesus says that's the way it's supposed to be. Both Lydia and the jailer are examples of that for us. Thirdly, as in the Old Covenant, the gospel continues covenantally to embrace families. We see this in the cases of both Lydia and the jailer, whose households were baptized upon their personal profession of faith. Now, this placed responsibilities upon the heads of these households to train up any baptized children in the faith. We don't presume upon the covenant. Rather, we live in light of its promises and the covenantal calling that is upon us. And we should again ask ourselves, do we show such care to covenant children in our families and in our church family? And then fourthly and finally, we see here gospel proclamation stirs up hostility from unbelievers. So there's nothing new under the sun. Should we be surprised when forces of unbelief attack Christians and Christian teaching in our day? Should that really surprise us? What would we expect from unconverted people? Paul's example shows that we should not seek out such treatment, of course, but neither should we allow true civil injustice to be perpetrated against us. Paul had rights as a Roman citizen that he was willing to claim in order to further the cause of the gospel. We also have civil rights that we should be willing to assert when others seek to deny us of them out of hatred for our faith. And to give a recent, very current example, this past Saturday was the Pride celebration in Jackson. It was originally scheduled for a city park, and some local people, mostly Christians, I think, rose up and said the city shouldn't do that. They said that they had to allow anybody to do it, but they found some laws that had things to declare about what was appropriate in public and what wasn't. And so they compromised to move it to the city hall. The big issue there was the drag queen show that was going to be put on, and the way that these drag shows are being used especially for young children to lead them astray. Well, not only were local officials and Christians who rose up able to get them to move it from outside, where it'd be visible to all in a park, to inside at the Carl Perkins Civic Center, but they also arranged so that that drag show would be held in a place so that only those 18 or over could enter. Now, I still don't think it's a great thing that they had that. But like Paul could appeal as a Roman citizen, local Christians could appeal to laws that are on the books that are intended to protect society from certain influences, and this fell under that, and they were rather successful, given the fact that in most places I think they would have been laughed at simply for raising the issue. As Christians, we are not revolutionaries intent on overthrowing government. We should be the best of citizens. As Paul tells us, the Lord placed the civil magistrates over us. He calls us to pray for them, and we should be active citizens. And while our primary citizenship is in heaven, we can still value and enjoy the benefits of our citizenship on earth. And Paul shows us that. And I do think that in these days, weeks, months, years ahead, we're going to have more opportunities for this until they change the laws. But there's still some good laws on the books that reflect a basic Christian consensus on morality. And we have every reason and every right to be able to point to those laws when the society seems to be going against them. So quite a few things that we can learn, I think, from Paul and Silas and their time in Philippi.